Robert Holloman, he's Mike Burns. Thank you, Robert. And thank y'all for having me here tonight. It's always a privilege and an honor to be able to participate in AA and in my own recovery. And I come to y'all from, I'm a member of the big town group in the small town of Etowah, North Carolina. And I always say Etowah, population about 49. We got about 48 home group members down there in Etowah. We still ain't caught that one up through the woods yet. We're going to get him one of these days. But it's an honor to be here and to be back to Georgia. You know, I love Georgia AA. I've met a lot of people here over the years and been to quite a few meetings around this area. And I love AA wherever I go, you know. And my sobriety date is September the 17th of 1992. And I'm just overwhelmed, you know, with just to be able to go and participate and to be able to go, you know, 150 miles away from home and to, you know, see people that I know and that I love and that I respect, you know, and I get to spend some time with some good friends you know, it just always blows me away how awesome this program is. And, you know, our book talks about the fellowship that grows up about us, you know, and since I've been coming down to Georgia probably the last 3 or 4 years, you know, I've had a fellowship of what would you call them, Georgians, grow up about, you know, and it's been amazing. And I was thinking about, I was reading on one of the websites here that the theme for the conference is going to be a design for living. And, you know, it's my life, as a result of coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and staying and to continue to be willing to do what you people ask or suggest me to do, you know, I've had good sponsors in AA who took me through our literature, who took me through the big book and through the 12 steps. And it's been absolutely incredible that that I've been willing to stay here and to continue to practice those steps in my life, you know. And that is the design for living. It's outlined in our first 164 pages of our book. You know, and I'm grateful that I came into a group of Alcoholics Anonymous that they studied the book. They believed everything that book said, and you know, and they taught me this program of recovery. You know, and you know, thank God for people who stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we need the old timers here, and I've got a lot of old timers, and I've been blessed. Where I came into AA in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was blessed to come into a group of old timers who, you know, just took me and taught me how not just to work this program, but to practice these principles outside of these rooms, you know, to be a good example out there, not just in here for an hour, but be an example out there, because I don't know who I'm going to run into out there that's going to end up in here. You know, and I want to be a good example, you know, as often as I can be, just in case. You never know who's coming in that door next. And so I was born in Charlotte back in the 60s. I was born to a good family. My dad left my mama when she was pregnant with me. And my mom had 3 small kids, and I was on the way, and she couldn't work, so my grandparents took us in their home. So I grew up in a good home. My grandparents worked in a Lutheran church, and they made sure the kids went to church growing up. And, you know, it was just, they taught us everything they were supposed to teach us, you know, as kids. You know, right from wrong, good from bad. You know, respect, responsibility. They taught us treat people like you would want to be treated. All those things that, you know, people teach their kids. And, but I didn't like going to church, you know. I remember I was a scared little kid, and I was afraid of the people in the church. You know, if you weren't in my family, I was afraid of you. And so I guess I had selective hearing even back then, you know. I didn't really pay that much attention to what they were talking about in this church. So, and there's no wonder I didn't get what they were trying to give me in there. I didn't like it. And as a small kid, I was scared to death, you know. And I was afraid that... You know, I'd never try to do anything because I knew I was going to be bad at it, so why try it and embarrass myself? So I just never would try anything. I never had any self-esteem, you know, and that all changed at 12 years old, the first time I got drunk. And And what happened was, you know, when I found out real early when I drank and felt the effects produced by alcohol that I can go places I normally can't go. I can be around people I normally can't be around, and I can do things I normally can't do. So why wouldn't you drink? If that, you know, and alcohol became that power I needed in my life. And, you know, our book talks about it in chapter 2, the agnostics, about our childhood beliefs and things like that. And it says in there that, you know, we neatly evaded or entirely ignored. You know, at 12 years old, I started evading that church and that, you know, that religion that my grandparents were in. And I'd go to church with them, but I'd sneak out and go out the back door and head over to the park where all them other boys were that didn't want to be in church, you know. So I started evading it. You know, and then by the time I was 15, I drank every day. I was a blackout drinker. And I entirely ignored God then. Alcohol became my master at 15 years old. You know, I drank every chance I got. And where I grew up in Charlotte, it was easy to get something to drink. I grew up by some railroad tracks near downtown Charlotte. We'd walk them tracks to school in the morning. We'd pitch our lunch money in and get them winos up on the bridge to get us something to drink. So we was drinking Mad Dog, Wild Irish Rose, and Night Train, and Orange Jubilee, all that good stuff on the, you know, all that good stuff on the way to school, 12, 13 years old, you know. A lot of times we'd overshoot the mark and couldn't make it to school. So I stopped going to school on a regular basis in the sixth grade. I didn't get no education, and I didn't have a desire for an education. I thought I knew everything, you know. And but I was a blackout drinker. I'd come to in places I never dreamed I'd come to. I went to a New Year's Eve party at 15 years old, Charlotte, North Carolina. Came to in Daytona Beach, Florida. You know, I don't know how I got there, you know. I stayed on the streets of Florida for 3 weeks, and I got locked up my first time in Lakeland, Florida. And they sent me back to Charlotte, North Carolina on probation, got back. My mama said, you need to turn yourself in. I said, for what? And me and a buddy of mine had robbed a little old lady in the neighborhood park, drunk, in a blackout. I don't remember doing that. So that should have told me early on that you ought not drink. You get in bad trouble, you know. And but see, I didn't care about that because of what alcohol did for me, you know. And that was the whole deal, you know. Consequences of my drinking didn't matter to me because of what alcohol did for me. I had to have it to be around y'all, you know. And so I went to jail a lot. And but I remember going to school. I hated going to school. I remember the first grade, 6 years old, went in there scared to death. They put me at a table with a guy beside me and two guys in front of me facing, you know. And I don't know what came over me, but I just spit on the guy in front of me. And they put me out in the hallway. And I was a quick study, you know. If I get in trouble, they'll put me out in the hallway. I'll be by myself. So I got in a lot of trouble in school, you know. And I made good grades up until the fifth grade, and I started drinking. You know, my grades started dropping off, and I hated it. I don't know how I made it through junior high school. I made D's and S in junior high school, and they passed me every year. They sent me to the 10th grade. And the only thing I remember about 10th grade is it was the funnest 3 years of my life, you know. Just head in the front door and go out the back and go drink, you know. And I was getting in a lot of trouble at home. I was sneaking out of the house at night, running the streets of Charlotte, you know. And my mama knew about alcoholism. My mama called me an alcoholic at 15 years old. You know, she had been married to an alcoholic. And so she knew, you know. And my mom, I'd sneak out of the house at night. And I'd try to get back, and I'd have to climb up on the roof to go up in the attic to get back in the house. And nobody'd know I went out as a kid. And I knew I was making all kind of noise, you know, but I never thought they really knew. And so a lot of times I'd forget, you know, I'm too drunk to climb up on the roof, so I'd have to go through the door. And I'd go in the door, and I'd try to be real quiet, you know. And my mama knew I was out, and she'd rearrange furniture. And I'd come in there, and I'd trip over a table or something, wake up the whole house, you know. And so I was in and out of trouble with her. And she told me, if you're not going to go to school, you need to go to work. So I quit school, went to work doing carpenter work, and found out they drank on the job, kind of like that. That was another thing I filed, you know, that every job I ever find, I'm going to find one I can drink on, you know. And I was working, one of my first jobs was with a framing crew, and they were from North Wilkesboro up in the mountains, and they drank corn liquor and smoked homegrown marijuana, you know, and I didn't care about that, but I liked that homebrew they had. And I remember we used to frame apartment complexes down there in Charlotte, and we'd all be up there, and it was five brothers, the daddy and five brothers, and me and a couple other little old boys I grew up with. And I remember we stand up on the second floor of this building, this apartment building, waiting on the forklift driver to bring the walls up to us. And the superintendent come up the ladder and he said, where's Harley at? And we looked around and old Harley, he was just right there with us. I don't know, he was just here. Well, here come Harley up the ladder. Well, we didn't find out until on the way home. Harley was up there with us drinking that corn liquor. He turned around and stepped off the second floor of that building. It didn't even faze him, you know. He just climbed right back up the ladder. And I'll tell you, them guys, you can't get fired working for people like that, you know. Either you just work till you get tired of working for them, or just quit, move on, or whatever, you know. And those are the jobs I seeked out. And most jobs would last about a year, year and a half at the most. And I'd move on to something different and done all kinds of different construction work. And I remember when I was 21 years old, I got my driver's license for the first time, and I wanted to find a job driving one of their vehicles because all my money went on drinking. And I found a job installing cable TV for a contracting company in Charlotte, and they gave me a big van to work out of. I don't know about y'all, but whenever I'm not comfortable staying somewhere, I'll move on. If it means staying on the streets, I'll stay on the streets. But they gave me that big van, and I was comfortable living in that, moving in that van. And I packed my clothes up and moved in. And I remember they gave me a gas car. I had plenty of gas money, you know. But I'd pull down on this creek bank in the woods down on the end of my neighborhood, you know, and all the drunks hung out down there on the creek bank in the weed patch. And I remember this one night, this girl came up, and she didn't like where she was living, so I let her move in with me, you know. My best friend was 23 years old. His daddy wouldn't let him in his house, but he let him sleep out in the backyard in a 56 Chevrolet station wagon. And his girlfriend moved in with him out there. For 3 years, they lived out in that car. And his daddy let him have a drop cord to hook power up. He got him one of them strip plugs you can hook six different appliances up to. Had a little heater for the winter, a fan for the summer, a little color TV, stereo out there in that car. And doing the work I did, I hooked his HBO and Cinemax up for him, you know. And good fight, come on HBO, we'd go over to her house and climb in there. I don't know about y'all, but two couples drinking in tight quarters like that, stuff will happen, you know. We'd end up out in the backyard fighting. And finally, his daddy got tired of it and run us all off, you know. And being the good friend I was, I let them move in with us. And now we got two couples living in a cablevision van. And it was really tight, you know, and it wasn't long after they moved in there, things started going downhill, because I know how roommates don't ever do what you want them to do. But, man, we had some good times out there, but we had a lot of bad ones, too. And I remember that was right up in the paper about the Beer Bandits, and we were part of that crew. we'd hit a convenience store and run out with cases of Budweiser, you know, and they said, oh, y'all won't do that. Watch this, you know, and we did that, and man, you can't outrun the Mecklenburg County cops at 3 o'clock in the morning in a cablevision van. They'll get you, you know. They got us. They impounded our home, you know. We did a lot of drinking out on the riverbank down there on Catawba River outside of Charlotte, a place called Hubie's Bubble Up. It was an old biker bar down there on the river. And we did a lot of drinking out there, and there was a trailer park out there. And a lot of them boys I worked with lived out there, so we'd go out there and drink a lot and stay out there with them. And one of them said, Mike, my boy ain't never been to Charlotte. He ain't never been to a bar. I said, I'll take him, you know. And I took this boy to Charlotte. Got me a fifth of George Dickel White Label and got him a 12-pack of Bud, and I was chasing my liquor with his beer. And we're hitting all these pool rooms up Central Avenue in Charlotte. And I remember I told that boy to grab the steering wheel so I could take me a drink. I took a drink of that liquor and chased it, and the blue lights came on. I pulled over, and the cop come up to my window, and I said, was I speeding? He said, no, you crossed that center line back there. I said, I just leaned back. You don't talk to this boy over here. He was steering. I didn't cross the center line. I wasn't speeding, so, you know, they locked up the wrong guy, right? So he didn't give me no roadside test. He drug me out by the hair of the head and locked me up. Impounded our home again, you know. It just kept getting worse. And the very next weekend, I got another DWI down in Lincoln, North Carolina. And it just kept getting worse and worse. I kept working for these people, living in their van, drinking on, you know, driving every day. And I started getting pulled over on driving on revoke. Finally, I had to quit that job. I went and told them people I quit. And they said, why are you quitting? Man, it costs too much money to work for you people. You know? I found out real quick, when you don't have a car or job, your girlfriend will leave you. And she left. And I was hanging out in these bars down in Central Avenue. And I remember going to these bars, and I always, you know, I always had work. You know, jobs didn't last long, but I always had a paycheck on Friday. And I might be broke on Saturday morning, but I got money on Fridays. And I'd go into a bar, and I'd set up a couple guys with some beers, and I'd say, let's get a half gallon of liquor and go to your house. And I'd get in your house. And I'd stay as long as I can, you know. It might be 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months, you know, never knew. And they'd run me off, and I'd go to the bar and do it again. And I was in this bar one night, and this girl came in and said, "Ain't you Bobby's brother?" And I said, "Yeah." I hadn't seen my brother in about 5 years, and she took me over into North Charlotte, which was a pretty rough area back then. And we pulled up in this driveway, and there's 30 Harley-Davidson motorcycles out in the yard. And I went in this house, and them bikers had guns strapped on them, and they drinking straight liquor out of the bottle, and I felt comfortable. I needed a place to stay, so I just stayed there. And come to find out, my brother was the president of a club down there in Charlotte, and that was their clubhouse, and I moved in. I went to work with a couple of them guys doing brick work, and I was mixing mortar and hauling brick, and them guys drank around the clock. Whenever you came to, you just started drinking, you know. And I remember, I'll tell you, one morning I woke up, and it was Sunday morning, I thought it was Saturday. And I woke up, and I opened up the fridge, and it was empty. I opened up the freezer, and there's about 6 frozen Budweisers. I pulled them things out, put them in the middle of the stove, turned on every burner, and I'm standing there turning Buds. My brother's girlfriend came in there and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm cooking breakfast." I said, "I'll tell you what, come over here. I'm going to run up to the store real quick, turn these beers every couple minutes." You know, I had her in there turning my beers for me. But they drank around the clock. And I remember we came home one day, and I think it was me and Toad and Snake was sitting there drinking a half gallon of Jim Beam. And down the hall, stepped out, the door opened up, the bathroom door opened up, and out stepped this beautiful Mi'kmaq Indian. She had hair down to her belt. I had hair down to my belt. She had more tattoos than I got, and that impressed me, because I'm covered up in them. But I remember drinking that liquor, and I blacked out. And when I came to, I was looking for the Indian, and she was gone. And I was hoping she would have been there, you know, and about 2 weeks later, I was down in this bar down on Central Avenue, and she walked in the bar with this young guy, and she came straight to me and said, "Mike, I'm taking you home with me tonight." I said, "Well, let's go." And I was pretty easy when I was drunk. She took me home with her. And she lived in, we call them drunk trailer parks, and I know down here in Georgia, y'all got some drunk trailer parks. Everybody in there is just drunk. She lived in the smallest trailer in this place, and the blocks in the back of the trailer was sinking. So it was at a slant. When you went in the front door drunk, you went straight to the back wall. You just slide down the hallway. She had her bed leveled off. She had it sitting on blocks on one side. We sat back there and drank a fifth of Jim Beam, passed out. But I remember the wind was blowing so hard, I thought it was going to blow the trailer over. And next morning we got up, we walked out of that trailer, and there was pine trees laying through trailers. We didn't know what happened. Went over and knocked on the neighbor's door and found out Hurricane Hugo hit that night. It tore Charlotte, North Carolina up. And we couldn't drive out of the trailer park, so I just stayed there with her, you know. We became best drinking buddies, and we ended up getting married in a beer joint down in Charleston, South Carolina. Her sister married us. People just say, "You ain't really married." And I knew we were, because I had to pay for the divorce. Well, we stayed drunk, you know, both of us in and out of jails. And she was a full-blooded Mi'kmaq Indian, man. I'm telling you, you don't give Indian liquor, and she'd throw handfuls of Xanax on top of that liquor, and she'd just get crazy. But I remember last time I came to her in a jail cell, I didn't know why I was in there, and I read my papers, and I should have been in there. I got out on bond, and I went home, and we lived in a little efficiency apartment. And it was small. It was probably about a 12 by 12 room. Had a little bathroom in it, a little kitchenette on it. Had one door in. And I walked in that door, and she was gone. And all her stuff was gone, but 2 little boxes sitting by the door. And I started drinking. And I remember it wasn't long after that, she walked in the door, one of her friends, and I saw why I was in that jail cell. I put 15 stitches in her head right here, drunk in a blackout. Don't remember doing it. And that hurt me, because that's one thing that I grew up, my grandparents and my mama taught me, you'll never hit a woman. And I've always believed that. I've always believed that. And so I was hurt, you know. And she got her stuff, got out of there, and I got evicted from this place, and I went back to the streets. And, you know, and I'm walking the streets at night, man, and I'm staying on people's couches that'll let me stay on their couch or, you know, whatever. And I remember walking the streets, man, not knowing, you know, what I'm going to do. You know, I don't know what I'm going to do. I didn't know there was a way out. I didn't know there was people who lived like me who found a way out through Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 28 years old. I never heard of AA. Never heard of treatment for alcoholism. I knew about a detox. I never went to it, but I knew guys that went to a detox. And I'll never remember hearing them talk about AA or anything. And I remember I found her over in North Charlotte and begged and pleaded with her to get back together. She said, "Mike, if you move back to your mama's house, we might, and quit drinking, we might get back together. That's the last place I want to go at 28 years old." And I'd walk, you know, I'd walk the streets and I thought, man, I'm just tired, you know. I'm tired of living this way. And I remember I went back home. My mama always told me I could come back home. I never would. I always said I was too proud. I know today I didn't want my family to see me in the condition I was in. I looked like a wild animal. And I went back home, you know, and it wasn't long after that we had to go to court. My wife got there before I did, and she tried to drop the charges. They wouldn't do it. And it was a state against me, and I was ready to go to prison that day. And I remember the judge read the charge, or the DA read the charge to the judge, told him what happened, and the judge looked at my wife and said, "What do you want to do with him?" And I said, "Well, she's getting ready to get even." And she stood up and told that judge, said, "Mike's a good man. Said he works hard, he helps his family when they need help, but he's crazy when he drinks." Well, I drank every day. You know? And that's all she said. She sat down, and the judge, and I'm sure he was looking at my record, and I've seen my record in Mecklenburg County since then. And I'm sure he was looking at my record, and it seemed like forever. And he told me to stand up, and I stood up, and he said, what I heard him say was, 2 years in the penitentiary or AA. Now, you ain't got to be the head cashier at Walmart to figure out the better deal, right? I don't know what AA is, but I know it ain't prison. I'll take the prison. I mean, I'll take the AA. But he gave me a lot of other stuff, and he sent me to meet my probation officer. I met the meanest woman I ever met in my life. She said, "Mike, when you have an appointment to see me, if you're late, I'm going to lock you up." And I'd go early, and she'd cuss me out for coming too early. But I just did everything that woman told me to do because I didn't want to go to prison for 2 years. And at that time, I did want to quit drinking, you know. So I left there and 2 years of probation, supervised probation. And I remember they told me I need to go over to this treatment center to take an assessment. I didn't know what that was, so I went over there and said, my probation officer sent me over here to take an assessment. And the woman handed me a book of questions. I went over and answered them, you know, and handed them back to her. And it was like handing the paper to the teacher. She graded it, and I got one wrong, and they told me I was an alcoholic. Said, "You need to come to treatment." I said, "No, I need a job. You know, I'm going to go find me a job." And they said, "Well, you do outpatient treatment for 18 and a half weeks." I said, "All right." And I hated it, man. I hated it. And I'd go over to this treatment center 3 hours a night for, three or four nights a week, and then have to go to five meetings on the weekend and prove I was going, or they'd kick me out and I'd violate and go to prison. You know, and that's the way I looked at it all, you know. And I hated going in that place and sitting around a group of men whining about their life. You know, I'm like, this is just crazy. And I was hanging out with the guys who didn't want to be in treatment, you know. And we'd go to the AA meeting and sit back in the back and laugh at all the funny people. And that's the way I felt, you know. I remember I hated it. And I remember, thank God it was a treatment center that took us to AA. The first meeting they took us to was the Hawthorne group in Charlotte, about 80 people in there. We walk in the meeting, the first two people I see is my junior high school principal sitting beside my Sunday school teacher. And that Sunday school teacher, I'm kind of worried about him because his daughters wouldn't live in that van with me. You know? And she died. And I was kind of worried about him. But I remember standing in the doorway of AA just judging everybody in there. You know, I could put my hair in my back pocket. I looked like a wild animal. I wore my cut-off Harley shirts. You can see all my tattoos. Had my teeth. I hadn't met my dentist yet. Had all my teeth kicked out fighting. And I remember, you know, standing there, all these shiny people, man. You know, I'm not like these people. But I kept going, you know. And I'd hear people say, "Well, all you got to do is just don't drink, go to meetings." And I'm sure that they followed that up with, get a sponsor, get a home group, work the steps, do service. But all I heard, and that selective hearing again, was just don't drink, go to meeting. And that's all I did. And I'll tell you, if you're new here, you can do that for a little while. And things can get better. And they did for me. You know, I did it for 8 months. Got my wife back. Got my driver's license back. Bought me an old van to drive to work and to AA meetings. Started buying furniture out of the store instead of getting offside the road somewhere. Everything was looking good. After 8 months, just 8 months of not drinking, had money in my pocket. And I was at work one day, and I thought, you ain't had a drink in 8 months. You can drink a couple beers. Well, she told me if I ever drank again, we'd split up. So I went home, started an argument, packed my clothes, and left. Went over to the old Charlotte Coliseum Motel, got me a 12-pack of Bud, and locked all four locks on the door. Drank three or four of them beers, nothing happened. Drank two or three more of them. I don't know about y'all, but when I get a buzz, there's always something better happening across town. I took off driving across Charlotte. Went in this ballroom. The bartender's pouring a double shot of tequila when I walk in. He's putting Tabasco sauce in there, and I knew that was my drink. He said, Mike, where you been? I said, man, I've been sober in AA for 8 months. He said, boy, you need this. I turned that double shot up and said, give me another one, you know. I don't remember leaving that bar. I blacked out. I came to the next day at 11 o'clock on the bathroom floor in that hotel room, sick as I ever been. I climbed up on the sink and I looked in the mirror and I hated everything I saw in that mirror. I didn't like me. I didn't want to live like that. I believe, you know, that was, I'm sure that's what got me back that night. And I was talking to my old sponsor, Buck, and I said, I don't know why I came back to AA that night. He said, Mike, you go to AA for 8 months. AA put a booger on you. And if you're new here, if you're planning on drinking some more, you've been boogered up. It ain't no fun no more. Just stay here with us, right? And, but I came back that night. That was September 17th of 1992. And by God's grace and Alcoholics Anonymous, and you people, I hadn't had a drink since then. And, you know, it was... my wife got drunk that same weekend and stayed drunk for a couple of weeks, and I lived in my van. I'd go into work. I had a good job, a new job, and going to meetings at night, and I'd sleep in my van. You know, I had some guys in AA say, you can sleep in my couch. I'm like, no, that's all right, you know, and I'd sleep in my van somewhere, and I'd get up and go to work. And I remember I was going to a lot of meetings, and my wife called me and said, I want you to come back, you know, and I went back one more time. For the next 11 months, I just came to AA so I wouldn't get in trouble. That's it. I didn't do anything. I knew I couldn't drink. I couldn't control it. I knew that. I was powerless over it. I knew that. But I just still wasn't convinced that I needed to do everything that y'all had to do to stay sober. I wasn't convinced of that. And I remember going to meetings, you know, and me and my wife, we were just arguing. And, you know, every time we'd get around each other, we just argue. We found out real quick, when we don't drink, we don't like each other. I'm serious. And I'd go to AA, you know, and she didn't go. And she quit on her own, and it didn't go too good. And I remember after 11 months, I was miserable, man. I was sitting in meetings, and I remember going to this group with about 70, 80 people in there. And I was sitting there, man, and you know, I couldn't imagine living the rest of my life not drinking. I know y'all people said, we do this one day at a time. I said, it's just a trick, ain't it? I'm tricking you. It's every day for the rest of your life. It's what I thought. And so, but I couldn't, man, I couldn't imagine living life with alcohol either, man. And I remember the last time I did drink, the way I felt when I came to on that floor. I knew I didn't want to live like that. And I really believe that was that turning point that How It Works talks about. I stood at that turning point, and I knew that I was going to have to ask another man to help me if I was going to stay sober. I knew that. And so my wife told me she was drinking again, so I packed my clothes up and I left, and I lived in my van for a little while, and I was going to a lot of AA meetings. Going to a group called Late Night East Side, a lot of young guys there. Probably 70 people at that meeting on Friday, Saturday night at 10 o'clock, and anywhere from 20 to 35 years old. They took meetings all over Charlotte. And they said, Mike, if you come go with us and do what we do, you don't ever have to drink again. And they said, even better than that, you won't ever have to be alone again. And they hooked me, man. I got in that group, and I got a sponsor in that group. And this sponsor, he asked me, when I asked the guy to be my sponsor, he said, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? Now, he didn't tell me what that looks like, but I said, yeah. And he said, will you give away freely what was so freely given to you? I didn't know what y'all were going to give me, but I said, yeah. And he said, well, I'll be your sponsor. He said, where do you live at? And I said, in that van right there. He said, well, you can stay with me till you get you a place. 2 weeks later, I moved in next door to the guy. We went to AA every day. And he would share his life with me, you know, and I'd share some stuff with him, but he would get deep, you know, and I'm like, there's some stuff I ain't going to tell you, buddy, you know. but it was on, you know, and that guy, he started me reading the book, and I couldn't hardly read when I got to AA. And it took me a while to read the first 164 pages. And I went back all excited. He said, read it again, you know. And I'm like, man, I'm having a hard time reading this stuff, you know. And he said, all right, meet me over at the church, you know, early on this Friday night. And I got over there early. And we got in the sanctuary of that church. And he started reading the book to me. And started sharing his experience with me. You know, and he, you know, I look back and I see where the first two steps are laid out as you know, all they really are is I have to be convinced that I'm powerless over alcohol, and I have to be convinced that I need power to overcome that. You know, but he shared a lot of stuff with me. He read out of the doctor's opinion about once an alcoholic puts any amount of alcohol in the system, it sets off a phenomenon of craving, which don't happen to normal people. You know, and he shared some of his experience, and I could identify. He said, you know, over on page 30, it talks about we had to concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics, that we couldn't have any kind of reservations, that somehow, someday, we'd be able to drink like we see other people drink. Those thoughts have to be smashed. And I pretty much smashed them, and I proved that to myself when I went out that one night. I went to drink a few beers, and I couldn't control it. I ended up in a blackout drunk in the hotel room floor. And I knew I was powerless over that stuff. So, yeah, I was convinced that I was powerless and my life was unmanageable. And he started talking about God. And thank God, man, that he read that chapter to the agnostics, you know. And, you know, he read in there that one line that says, you know, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely, or while drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. You know, and, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that I'm an alcoholic. But he went on and read a lot of stuff out of that chapter, you know, and he told me that, and I believed in God. I just never had any conception or any faith in it. Growing up in that home, there was no way I couldn't believe in something, but I never had faith in it. And what has he ever done for me? I can't see him, feel him, or hear him, you know. And he said, that's all you need is just to be willing to believe in something to move on to the third step. But he went in deeper, you know, and he read some more stuff to me, and he shared about his God with me. You know, and he read this one paragraph where it talks about thousands of men and women, worldly indeed, flatly declared that since they came to believe in a power greater than themselves, took a certain attitude toward that power, and did a few simple things, they've had a revolutionary change in the way of their living and thinking. And I said, man, I want that. You know, I want that, man. And he talked about the insanity of alcoholism. When I stood at that time clock and I ain't had a drink in 8 months, those thoughts came into my head, you know. You ain't had a drink in 8 months. You can drink a couple beers. That's the insanity of alcoholism. It centers in my mind. And he shared some of his experience and I could identify with it, you know. And he started talking about selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. He looked at me and said, alcohol ain't your problem. That's just a symptom of your problem. And I'm like, really? He started reading some more. Any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. You know, and he shared a lot of stuff, and I reflected on my past, you know, and that's where I realized that, you know, yeah, I started evading God, and then I entirely ignored Him. At 15, man, I was self-will run riot. I made all my own decisions based on self that placed me in a position to be hurt over and over and over again my whole life. He shared some of his experience and I could identify with him, you know. We got on our knees and we prayed that third step prayer and we got off our knees. He said, I want you to get on your knees and read that out of the book every morning. And I started doing that. And he pulled out his four-step inventory. He started reading the book to me and he got me right into an inventory. You know, and I look back over my life in sobriety, man, and I see how necessary, you know, 4 through 9 was, because everything through 4 through 9 is what's been blocking me from God my whole life. You know, all those hates and fears and resentments and all that stuff that I can't let you see or know about me, I've been stuffing my whole life, and that's what's been blocking me from God. You know, and I had to get it all on paper and share it with another human being, you know. And I had to go back and make restitution. You know, and I realized today that in 6 and 7, you know, it's all about change for me, man. It's all about, you know, I heard over at the book study, Bob D. talk about, somebody asked a sponsee, you know, What do you want to be in life, or how do you want to be? And he told him how he wanted to be. He said, well, okay, now act like it. You know, and my character defects, man, you know, I can't work on my character defects. What I do is, you know, my first sponsor, he told me, he said, all right, you're a thief. Don't steal no more. Right? Okay. You're a liar. Tell the truth. You know, and it was that simple for me. I just started changing, you know, my old behaviors. And, man, I'll tell you, I started going out to this prison when I was a year sober at Camp Green in Charlotte. And I was going in there, and I still put my hair in my back pocket, and I still wore them cut-off shirts. And I'd go into AA meetings out there. I went out there about a year and a half, and we'd be in the meeting, and they would say, and they would call for count, you know, they're going to count all the inmates, make sure they're all there, you know. And we're in the meeting, and a guard will come in and count all the inmates, and then they'd go out, and then he'd come back, and he'd count them all, and he'd go out, and he'd come back, and he'd say, everybody from the outside, raise your hand. And they counted me as an inmate every time. And I was like, are you saying I look like a thief or an inmate? He's like, yeah. So I changed, you know. I wanted to change. I didn't want to look like a thief or a criminal anymore, you know. And I started cleaning up, you know, on the outside too. And you know, my first sponsor said, Mike, you only have to change one thing. And I said, what's that? And he said, everything. Like, man. He said, you don't have to do it all at once, but, you know. You know, so, you know, I'm grateful for that. I was about a year and a half sober. I started going to AA conventions, or going to conventions put on by AA members all over the state, in South Carolina, and at Myrtle Beach, and started meeting a lot of people. And, you know, I got hooked going to conventions, and I go to a lot of them. And, you know, it's been absolutely incredible, you know. And I remember my second sponsor I met, he was doing the recordings. And I went up and asked that old man, I said, you look like you need some help. He had two canes, he couldn't hardly see, and he had all his equipment, you know. And I, can I help you load that up? He didn't even think about it. He handed me the keys and said, I'm parked out front in that red van. I took off out the door with thousands of dollars worth of audio equipment. And when I come back, that old man had a grin from ear to ear. And he said, you want to go with me to Raleigh next week? I said, man, I'd like to. And he took me to the state convention. I got to help him. On the way back, he said, you want to go to Virginia Beach with me? I said, yeah. And I started going everywhere that man went for the next 8.5, 9 years. And I remember when I was 3 years sober, he gave me a medallion at his home group. And he was telling that story about me coming up and asking if he needed help. And I still had that hair, and I'm still, you know, and he didn't know me. And when I took off out that door, when I come back, he had that big grin. When I walked out of that door, he said, I thought that guy was going to steal all my stuff, you know. And he had the keys in my van, too. And I knew when I come back, that big grin, he was happy to see me come back. And it was like an instant trust, you know. And he became my second sponsor, and he took me back through the 12 steps again, you know. And I went everywhere that man, him and his wife, Virginia, went for the next 8.5 years. And they introduced me to people from all over this country, you know. And it's been absolutely incredible, the people that he got to know, you know. His old sponsor was a guy named Wilson Booty that got sober in Cleveland in 43. And he was 12-step by Clarence Snyder, and y'all know where that goes. But, you know, just that man taught me a lot. And not just about the program, but about living life outside of these rooms, you know. And I'm grateful for that. And I had me an apartment. I started collecting antiques because I never owned anything. And I was proud of this stuff, you know. I got home about, I was 3 years sober. I got home, you know, and I had all these antiques, and I was proud of this stuff. And I tried to get you to come over to my house to see all my stuff. And I remember I got home, and sometime during the night, I turned the TV off about 2 o'clock in the morning. I went to bed. Sometime during the night, I rolled over, and my arm went underwater. And you can imagine what I thought. I thought, well, I don't do that anymore. I quit drinking. And when I stepped out of bed, it was waist deep. And I was in shock. And see, I grew up drinking on this creek bank. And it had rained so hard so fast that night, it flooded out 280 apartments. And it was daybreak on a Sunday morning. And I remember I got up and I found a camera and I started flashing it around. And I started thinking about drinking down on that creek bank. When the water rose, you'd see snakes and rats and all kinds of stuff come through there. And I need to get some clothes on. And I got dressed, and I stepped out my back door, and it came up to my chest up here. And I couldn't get on my knees and pray that morning. And I just looked up, and I said, God, help me. My next thought was, And I believe today this is that God consciousness that the book talks about in the spiritual experience. Help people get out. I started helping my neighbors get out. You know, and then all of a sudden the rescue people made me get out, and I went and called my first sponsor, and AA showed up 6:30 on a Sunday morning, and they stayed with me until 1:30 that afternoon after the water went down. And we went in that apartment, and I lost everything. All of my antiques was trash. And I remember my first sponsor grabbed me around the neck, hugged me, and said, "Mike, cry if you need to," and he cried with me. He told me something I thought was pretty crazy. He said, "Mike, maybe God wants you to have better stuff." I wasn't feeling it. I wasn't feeling it. He took me back in his home for the next month. AA took care of me. They took me to work, picked me up. They took me to meetings. They fed me. They gave me clothes. I could have filled this room up with furniture, but I didn't have nowhere to put it, so I didn't take no furniture. But I stayed close. I had a commitment out to prison. I was sponsoring guys. I was doing the deal, you know. I stayed close. Like our third step talks about, if we perform His work well, He'll provide for us. And I kept doing this work. And I was provided for, you know. I love in Bill's story where he talks about, you know, he's having rough times, you know, and it's full of resentment. He would go down to the hospital and he would talk to a drunk or talk to a man in the bed. And when he left there, he felt lifted up. And then it goes on to say, it's a design for living that works in rough going. And it does, man. I'm living proof of it. You know, everything that's happened to me in sobriety, and some of the worst things that I've ever experienced has been in sobriety. If I stay close and perform His work well, I'm provided for every single time. Every time. And I've seen a lot of my friends in AA the same way. Same way. And 2 years later, those apartments flooded out again. I told them boys to get flood insurance, and they didn't. And I got home from work one day, and I got a call, and this guy was left a message on my machine. I called him, and he was on a cell phone. He was getting ready to walk into his apartment right after the water went down. And he said, "Oh, my God, Mike, I've lost everything." I knew exactly how that guy felt. I experienced that. I was able to share with him everything I went through. As a result of that flood, some of the greatest things that could have happened to me in my life happened as a result of that flood. I can't feel it or see it when I'm going through it, but if I make it through it, I'm going to be able to use it. You know, I'm going to be able to use it. And so I told that boy, everybody who was going to help him out, and I told him something he probably thought was pretty crazy. Maybe God wants you to have better stuff too, man. I don't know. You know? And that was 2 years later. I'm still learning lessons. It don't matter what happens to me, good or bad. If I stay close and do this work, I'm provided for, you know. And that's when I really realized that. And I remember when I went to clean up the wreckage of my past, you know, I went back. I had a lot of family. I didn't know where they were. You know, I made it a point to stay away from my family when I was out there most of the time. And it's like I said, because I didn't want them to see me the way I was. But I cleaned up and I was sober a few years, and I went back in the church I grew up in, and I met family that I hadn't seen in 20 years. New family members I didn't even know I had. You know, and it was just absolutely amazing some of the things that happened to me as a result of cleaning up the wreckage of my past. You know, I hear people come in, these beginner meetings or whatever, and the guy sitting there had been sober 21 days. The promises are coming true in my life. Man, I didn't have a clue how free you could be until you clean up the wreckage of your past. I was looking over my back when I got to AA. My name was Scott when I went into my first few meetings because I didn't know. I didn't know if some of those people that was after me was in here, you know. And so, man, I didn't know how free you could be, that I can look anybody in the eye, you know. I don't have to try to escape or feel any shame about my past anymore, you know. And our book talks about our darkest past becomes our greatest asset, you know. We get to use that stuff to help others. But I went back up to visit with my mom, and my mom was going through some hard times, and she had lost her job, and she couldn't pay her bills. And what she did was, she ended up quitting her job at one time to take care of both of her parents, and they both died at home. You know, my mom was a nurse, and she wanted them to die at home. They built that home in 1943, and that's where they died. And so my mom was going through hard times, and I went up there, and, And I was able to take all that better stuff up there and share with my mom. And we started having a relationship. I never had a relationship with my mom. I can't ever remember telling my mom I loved her, ever. And I remember I'd come to AA and I'd say, why can I come here and hug and hug up on any one of you and tell you I love you? I can't even do that with my own mama. I said, all you got to do is just do it. And it wasn't that easy. And I remember she come down the hall one night and I grabbed my mom and I hugged her and told her I loved her. First time I can ever remember doing that. She said, I love you too. And it got easier. And I remember, I'd come home from work and we'd sit down at the dining room table and talk. Something I've never done. I didn't know about my mom's life. I didn't know what she's been through in her life. And I started learning and having a relationship with my mom. My mom told me about my dad. And I met my dad 3 times my whole life. The last time I saw him, I was 17. And I hated him. He left my mom with 4 kids and never paid her a dime. And I hated that man with everything I had. He was number one on my list. And my mama started talking to me about my dad. Said, Mike, your dad lived on the streets of Charlotte, 15 years old. He'd been locked up hundreds of times, public drunk. He went to prison for armed robbery. My mama said, you were just like him. And when she said that, that resentment washed away. And what I realized was that man was doing the best he could. He was a hard drinker. I can't say he was an alcoholic, but he was a hard drinker. He was a sick man. And what I realized was if I'd have had one kid out there the way I was living my life, there's no way I could have took care of that kid. And I believe he gave us a break. I really believe that. And I was able to let him know that before he died in a letter. I didn't know where he was at. I found out he was out in Grants Pass, Oregon. I was able to send that man a letter and let him know I didn't hate him. And that's just been one of the great experiences, But I remember I was traveling, going to these conferences with my old sponsor, Buck, and we were supposed to go up to Blackstone, Virginia, and my mom was getting sick, and I told Buck, I said, Buck, I can't go, man. This was in October of 98, and he said, you need to stay home and take care of your mom. And I said, all right. So I remember I told my mom, I'm going to take you to the hospital in the morning, and them nurses are the hardest ones to go to the doctor. And I told her, if you're not ready, I'm going to pick you up and carry you, because she couldn't hardly breathe. And so I woke up that Thursday morning early, and she was getting ready. And I took her, and they did some x-rays, and they put her in a room. And I stayed with my mom that day until 7 o'clock that evening. My mama said, Mike, there's nothing you can do here. You need to be with them AA people in Virginia. And I said, are you sure? She said, yeah. And she loved you people. She didn't know who you were, but she loved you. She knew y'all saved her boy's life. And I remember, man, I was reflecting. When I got back, I went up to Virginia, and I came back, and I called her doctor, and her doctor said, Mike, your mama has terminal lung cancer, and she ain't going to live long. I said, well, how long is that? And he said, maybe 3 months. And that just tore me up. I remember I brought my mom home, and I took care of my mama. And I wanted my mama to die in her home, just like she did with her parents. And it was hard. It was really hard. And I remember I started taking care of my mom. And I remember late at night, my mom would climb in my bed and she'd put her hand on my shoulder and she'd be crying like a little baby. And I didn't know what to say to her. And I know today I didn't have to know what to say to her. And I'd take her in my arms and I'd hold her. And just let her know I was there with her. And I remember I was reflecting back at all the pain and misery I put that woman through, over my whole life. I went on these railroad tracks at 17 years old with a pint of Everclear and some long neck buds. I don't remember coming off them railroad tracks. I came to the next day on the living room floor of that house, and my mama knew about alcoholism. And she was laying in that floor holding her baby boy through his sickness. And I remember I climbed up off the floor and I looked around that house and I broke and busted up anything you could break or bust up in a drunken rage. And I never thought my alcoholism affected anybody. I know today that my alcoholism affected everybody I come in contact with somehow. I was, man, what an honor and a privilege it was to be there to be able to hold my mama through her sickness. And she don't have a way out. My mom always said, Mike, when are you going to take me to AA? And I'm going to be honest, I was ashamed to take my mama to AA. I didn't want to take her to an open speaker meeting. You never know what you're going to get. Seriously. My mama was a good Christian woman, and I told her about our spiritual program, and I told her about the God of my understanding. You know, and my mom's a religious woman, and I didn't want to take her to an open AA meeting where the guy's up there damning and, you know, F this or whatever. You know? And Dave C. from Burlington will speak. Dave C. from Raleigh was speaking at Bill C.'s 30th anniversary down there in Charlotte. And Dave C. will be celebrating 60 years in September the 12th. And he's big influence in AA in North Carolina. But he was coming to speak in Charlotte, and I knew that night my mama was going to get the best of AA that night. And I took her, and she got to meet you people, man. She got to hug you people. And she got to thank you people. And that was her impression of AA, and thank God for that. Thank God for that. And she loved you people. I was able to be there with her when she died. I remember when hospice came in, she tried to hook me up with a head hospice nurse. She's still looking out for her boy, you know. I didn't have the heart to tell her she was gay. It probably wouldn't work out, but I just let her be a mama, you know. I know today my mama's proud of me, man. You know, I know she's looking down on me and saying that old boy's doing good. And I married a hospice nurse today. And a lot of you people know my wife, Kathy. She spoke at Fifth Tradition not long ago. And incredible woman. Great sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we have a great life, you know. I met Kathy down in Myrtle Beach in 93. She was married to a guy. I always say a Don Johnson wannabe. And I was in my Greg Allman phase at the time. She was in her Liz Claiborne phase at the time. And we became friends, you know, her and her first home group down in Myrtle Beach, the primary purpose group. I became friends with all them people, and I got to meet a lot, you know. I'd see them in different areas and around AA. And back in 95, we were recording her over in Camp Monroe, this old retreat out there that started in 1960. And I remember she was getting ready to take off travel nursing out on the West Coast. And I remember telling her, I probably won't ever see you again. Yeah, we'll see each other again someday. 5 years later, she's coming back to AA, and she comes into a meeting down in Belmont, North Carolina. I believe Belmont population about 2 down there. I don't know. But she came in, you know, and she sat in between me and Buck because the treatment guys were hitting on her. She said, I didn't come back here for sex. I want to get sober. And she knew she was safe between us, you know. And I didn't know, but she already had a plan. She 13 stepped me when she was on her 9th step. In May, we'll celebrate 16 years marriage, man. We've got an incredible life. We had a dream of building a log cabin on top of a mountain, and that dream came true. You know, and as far as you can see, 180 degrees, just rolling hills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. We're down there by the Land of Waterfalls where they filmed The Last of the Mohicans and The Hunger Games, you know. It's absolutely incredible. And what happened was we still realized that it don't matter how long we stay sober, we can still make bad decisions. We can still make bad decisions. We built that home up there on that mountain. We lived up there for 3 years, and the whole time we couldn't afford to live there. And we're struggling to keep it. You know, and it was all an ego, man. Look at this. We're on top of the hill. You know, and we finally surrendered. We finally surrendered, and we came off the mountain and went into foreclosure. And I'll tell you, it was a huge relief, you know. And we didn't file bankruptcy. We're paid back everybody we owe money to because that was our fault, you know. And we feel good about that. But one thing that we realized, or that I realized, I had another spiritual awakening, 15 years sober. And what it is that if I've got to struggle to get something I really want, or if I get something that I really want and have to struggle to keep it, maybe it's God's will I don't have it and move on. And I'm going to tell you, man, life is so much easier. Life is so much easier. You know, I try to practice these steps in my life a day at a time, and, you know, I do an inventory, daily inventory. I get on my knees and, you know, I thank God for my sobriety. I get up and I get on my knees and I ask my God for direction. I know I need that direction in my life. You know, and as a result of all that, I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of those steps. You know, and it's a trip. I got guys that I sponsor, and yeah, they're big on, yeah, I believe, I believe, I believe. Yeah, but are you aware? Are you aware that God is working in your life? You know, I can see them, feel them, and touch them today. I never could. You know, I remember I was going through some stuff. I had Hep C, and I was getting ready to do some treatment and that interferon, and I was scared. My wife was scared. And I remember, you know, we prayed before I took that first shot of interferon. All that fear of all them war stories I've seen from people in the program that's done that. And my sponsor now, Bob, had me read something out of a book, and I read it, and he said, read it every day. And what I realized, man, that I've always had that God consciousness. I've always had it. Back in the day when I was running the streets of Charlotte, my mind would say, don't go down there, something bad is going to happen. And I'd go the other way and I'd hear about what happened. I didn't know that was a God consciousness. I always thought I was smart like that. You know, and that was a new awakening. And so I've had that spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You know, I try to carry this message to the still suffering alcoholics, man. I've always had institution work. Right now I'm going out to the Riverside group at Craggy Prison down there in Asheville every Wednesday night. I'm sitting in that prison cell. Love it. Man, one of my favorite meetings I go to. I did jails for the last 7.5 years. 2 different jails. You know, and how it works, it says practical experience shows that nothing will so much assure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when all other activities fail. If you're not happy about your sobriety, try to help another drunk, man. That's what's going to take you out of yourself and let God take care of the problems in your life. I believe that. I totally believe that. Like it says, it's a design for living through rough going, man. Just keep on trudging, and you'll make it through it. But I'll tell you, it also says in this forward to the second edition, it says it also indicated that strenuous work one alcoholic to another was vital for permanent recovery. You don't ever have to drink again if you don't want to. You can come in here and work this program and continue to try to carry this message and stay sober the rest of your life. And I've been blessed to meet a lot of old-timers who came in once and died sober, with 40, 50 years sober, you know. And that's absolutely incredible. I want to be like those guys. And then we try to practice these principles in all our affairs. You know, people will come out with these little cards, you know, 12 principles. The forward to the 12 and 12 says that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are principles, spiritual in nature. If practiced as a way of life, it'll expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happy and usefully whole. So those 12 steps are the spiritual principles. And I need to wake up in the morning. I need to realize I'm powerless today. I can't take a drink. I need to get on my knees and ask God for direction. I need to, you know, plan my day and go out and try to do the best I can and take care of my responsibilities and be on time. And if I do that and I stay sober, I need to get on my knees and thank that God for that day. And I do that, man, and it's a privilege to be able to do that. I don't ever want to go back to the old life I was living. And I'll tell you, I'm still as willing today as I was when I came in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm still willing to make commitment and keep it. You know, I know I'm talking too long, but I'm going to sit down. I heard a man who lived down on the coast, and every morning he'd get up and he'd walk, and this one day he was walking, he saw way off in the distance somebody was picking something up and throwing it in the ocean. When he got down there, he saw where thousands of starfish washed up on the beach. And he got down to the man, he said, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm throwing these starfish back in the ocean. And the guy said, what difference can you make? There's thousands of them. Thousands. And he reached down, he picked one more up and said, makes all the difference in the world to this one. And threw them back in the ocean. I can identify with that story. The way our book talks about the way we roar through people's lives like a tornado. I know my alcoholism affected everybody I come in contact with somehow. And I really believe that that wind stopped blowing that morning I ended up in that courtroom. And that judge knew more about me than I knew about myself. The judge was sober over 20 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And out of the thousands of drunks that went through his courtroom, I was one that he picked up and threw in the rooms of AA. And as a result of becoming willing to ask another man to help me, to try to do this the best I can, a day at a time. Practice these steps in my life. There's no doubt in my mind this program saved my life. And if you're new here, Stay with us. If you don't think this is for you, give it a chance. Look around at the people who's doing the work. They're the happiest ones around here. Go up to them and say, hey man, have you ever worked steps with a sponsor? If they say no, run from them. If they say yes, say, well, you show me how. And just give it half of what you gave your drinking, and I guarantee you it'll save your life too. Thank y'all.